The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Good morning and welcome to Campus Voices here at WVUD. I'm Richard Gordon, and two of our students, Allie Delaney and Sam O'Donnell, are in here with me, and today we're going to be talking with Professor Jennifer Lamb from the Communication Department about free speech. That's a topic near and dear to your heart, isn't it, Jen?
It is indeed.
So, Professor Lamb, what exactly is free speech in America?
It comes from a tradition when we broke off from England. In England, they had instituted some things that the people who came to the United States weren't comfortable with. Most importantly, they were giving people copyrights, but in that time, copyright meant that you got basically a license to be able to publish. And so the government would review things or at least give you the approval to publish things. And so if you went, or, you know, if you published something they didn't like, you could lose that right. And so when people came here, they felt very strongly about keeping the government out of freedom of expression as much as possible. And so our First Amendment right is really based on the idea that the government should not be involved in what people say, in religion, and some of the other aspects that are included in the First Amendment as well.
Even with our First Amendment tradition, we have limits on the things we can say. What kind of limits are there?
So it depends on the type of restriction that the government wants to put forth. So if the government wants to stop something before it goes out, which is called a prior restraint, that is an extremely difficult thing for the government to be able to do successfully. That is sort of the traditional idea of what censorship is just not allowing it to happen at all. That is really, really hard. There's very few things that you can do.
What would the United States government do that for, or would they?
So some of the things that they would do, you're allowed to have prior restraint for things like making sure that somebody gets a fair trial. Child pornography is not given any First Amendment right, so you can absolutely bar that before it goes out. If something is declared to be obscene, then it doesn't have a First Amendment support anymore, and that can be kept. And then also things like if you wanted to publish something that was going to harm national security, so if you were going to publish where the troops were going to be next and that would possibly put them in danger, that sort of thing has been allowed to be censored as well.
So how do we balance free speech with freedom of expression? Just making sure that people don't feel like they're censored too much in what they're trying to say?
Balancing is that's really the crux of it, because every country places limits on freedom of expression. It's a very important goal, but it's not the only goal. And so it's that question of how do you draw the line that gets really sticky, because you can ask people if they support freedom of expression, and in the abstract, almost everyone will say yes. But when it comes to specific situations where some other social goal is sort of hitting up against freedom of expression, that's where people are much more willing to say, oh, yeah, except for that.
How does media influence or provoke our freedom of expression?
Can you explain what you mean by that a little bit?
More like social media. How does that affect the way people feel that they can express themselves?
Yeah, so social media has been a whole nother animal in terms of dealing with freedom of expression. The Supreme Court has actually said that different media get different amounts of free expression. So broadcast media has a little bit less because they use the electromagnetic spectrum, and so they're supposed to serve the public interest, and so they can be regulated a little bit more. But the internet has been wide open, and because it's not centralized, there's no central place that it goes through like there is for radio or print media or any other kind of media, then it's very difficult to shut that down. Like, even if you shut something down, they can find another place to put it up in another country even, and people can access it in a different place. So it's very difficult. And social media, in particular, things where people can be anonymous, have raised all kinds of problems in terms of pushing the boundaries of where free speech gets to the point where it needs to be.
Yeah, there was a case like that up the road at Penn this year where a student admitted to Penn but not attending started a Mudman group or something like that?
Yeah.
In a social media platform, and it made it appear that Penn students were racist.
If I'm correct, it was that particular forum, you could add people without them choosing to be added to a particular group. And so somehow the student had gotten access to the names of African-American students who had just been admitted to Penn and added them to this group. And so they were seeing all these horrible messages, and they didn't know who the person was that was posting these. They didn't know how many different people might be posting these things. And so it was not a very welcoming way to start for those students.
Speaking of Facebook, I know recently the New York Times released that quiz about what Facebook considers hate speech or not. What do you think about all of that? Because I know personally, Allie and I are in a journalism class, and we actually took the quiz as a class, and most people assumed things were hate speech that actually by Facebook standards were not considered hate speech.
Yeah, and vice versa. Like the thing about the white men, I think, was interesting. This one says white men are assholes, which, you know, is not a nice thing to say, but it's not particularly threatening to anybody. But they consider that to be hate speech. But they don't consider
About poor black people,
yeah,
sitting
the poor
at the back
black
of the
children.
That was nuts.
Yeah. I can't find that one for some reason, but it was something about,
I believe, poor, it was like poor black people need to still sit at the back of the bus.
Yeah, and that was not considered hate speech. And so I think what you define as hate speech depends on the purpose for which you're doing it. And part of the problem for Facebook is that they have to do a lot of this. They have to be able to set up parameters for the computer to recognize it and not have people necessarily seeing it, because it's so much information all the time that they have to be able to set up something that is a rule. And in fact, it's really hard for hate speech to set up a rule because there's so much contextual about it that it's like people can use perfectly innocuous words and still be saying something very hateful.
How does Facebook kind of not allows, but doesn't necessarily take away from hate speech? Would you say that increases polarization in the country?
I think it does. And part of it is, now, Facebook at least doesn't have it anonymous, so people have to actually claim what they're saying. I mean, I think some people do set up anonymous things and whatever, but for the most part, that's not an anonymous site. But Facebook, I think, not only through people saying these sorts of things, but also through the algorithms that they use, are sort of exacerbating this polarization that's happening. So when I talk about the algorithms, what I mean is that Facebook has a way, you know, they want to keep you on the site as long as possible, keep you there as much as possible. And so we have, as humans, a tendency to want to see things that we agree with. And so what they do, what the way their algorithm is set up, is that they will put things in your newsfeed that are like things that you've already seen and liked. And so if you are a staunch Republican, you're going to see a lot of things that are from a Republican point of view. If you're a staunch Democrat, you're going to see a lot of things that are from the Democratic point of view. And so you don't really hear the full marketplace of ideas on Facebook. You hear things that you already agree with. And that really can serve to exacerbate those tensions between different groups.
We're talking today with Professor Jenny Lamb from the Communication Department about free speech and hate speech. And you just said that Facebook's algorithms tend to make sure you see things you're likely to agree with already. Isn't that one of the problems with a lot of what we call hate speech now, is that it's like reinforcing people's point of view and whatever thing it is they believe in?
That's the other definitional question, is everybody has something that they think is hate speech because it touches on something that's close to them. And so, you know, being able to sort of legally define what hate speech is and what should be censored becomes a very difficult question, because it can't be just based on personal preference, because everybody has a different one.
How exactly would you define hate speech then? Because I know, again, it is such an ambiguous topic, and I know a lot of people interpret it different ways, but from your communications perspective.
If you're going to give just sort of a general term for it, I would say it is expression that attacks someone or group of someone's for a characteristic that is immutable with them. So it can be race, gender, ethnicity, handicap status, that's sort of just a very broad version of it. But I think the way that you say the definition has to depend on the purpose for which you're putting together the definition. So, for example, if you're doing it legally, it has to be able to be very, very clear what the definition is and what it isn't, because there's all kinds of issues with things being vague or things being overbroad. If you're Facebook or somebody else trying to put together something to control hate speech on your site, then it has to be something very different, because it has to be something that makes sense in terms of writing computer programming. How you're defining it is going to be very different depending on the purpose for which you're defining it.
Is hate speech protected by the First Amendment?
Yes, it is.
Really?
Yes.
Oh.
Unless it is a direct incitement
to violence,
to imminent violence. Like if somebody's going to get hurt physically right now because you're saying something, then that's not protected. But otherwise, it is protected by the First Amendment. Yes.
It's not great.
Well, every other Western democracy has some law against hate speech, but the United States does not.
What do you think about that? Do you think we should?
You know, part of the reason that I find this topic so interesting is because I don't have a great answer to that. I do think that there are some aspects of hate speech that should be more controlled. So, for example, when, you know, the trolls go after some individual person for something and start doxing them, start publishing their names and address and threatening to kill them, I think that there should be more restriction than there is right now. There's not a very good response to that. And that, I think, needs to be improved. But in general, I actually think that we're better off not having governmental restrictions on hate speech, because it's not like you're going to make the hate go away by pretending it doesn't exist. In a lot of ways, I would rather hear what people have to say or let them say what they want to say and then answer it with your own expression or through some other mechanism rather than there being a legal control over it.
As for legal control, you said that you don't know the answer to that necessarily, but what are the roles of universities or colleges? Because that's not the government. What do you see as the role for that in regulating hate speech or making everybody feel safe or comfortable on campus?
Particularly when a lot of schools, particularly public schools, have got that tradition of academic freedom covering,
right,
you know, freedom of expression even more so in some cases than the First Amendment.
So importantly, the government, in terms of freedom of expression, First Amendment, doesn't just mean the federal and state government. It also includes public universities. If it's a private university, that's a different matter. If it's a company, that's a totally different matter, a private company. But if it's a state university, they actually are bound by the First Amendment as well. And so, for example, Richard Spencer, nobody invited him. Nobody from the University of Florida invited him to come to campus. He and his group asked to rent space to be able to give a speech. And because the university rents space to other people, they couldn't say no based on the content of his speech. That's part of what the regulations are for the first free speech too, is that if a government regulation is going to survive, it has to be applied in a content neutral way, so that if it's Black Lives Matter or if it's Richard Spencer, white nationalists, or if it's I Love Banana Club, whatever, that whoever wants to rent it, if you're going to rent it out and offer it to the public, you have to offer it to anybody unless they're saying something illegal.
To me, maybe it's because I, like you, Jen, work at a university. I've just been amazed at the number of things that have come up in the news. You talked about the white nationalists down at the University of Florida. In the summer, we had the battle at William & Mary when some Black Lives Matter students shouted down ACLU. That to me is crazy. ACLU protects everybody's speech.
I think part of what's happening, and you know, people are very quick to say that, oh, college students today are just snowflakes and they're not willing to listen to these kinds of things. And I think part of what's happening is, and there's some research to show this, that students feel like the First Amendment gets used as a cudgel against them, and that people who have concerns want to be able to express concerns about freedom of expression without being able to say that they're somehow trying to make a speaker not heard. So it's one thing, like in the case of Richard Spencer, they ended up actually basically shouting him down, which I'm not a fan of. That they refer to that as the heckler's veto, where the crowd reaction makes the government somehow respond to the person and shut the speech down. I'm not a fan of that strategy, but I think there are lots of other strategies that can be used to sort of recognize, like, free speech is not free. And the cost for hate speech is disproportionately borne by people who are already marginalized. I think it's important for universities to recognize that when they are dealing with these kinds of situations on campus. It's not enough to just say, we disagree with this person. You need to be able to have discussions about why we are allowing this person to speak, even though what they have to say is horrible, and that we as a campus need to be able to have discussions around these topics. And yes, we recognize this is painful for you and acknowledge that, and that you have your own free speech to be able to say these things in answer to somebody and not to just be sort of shut down because you disagree.
I don't hear dialogue there. I hear you talking about two different groups shouting their points of view and not listening to each other.
Well, and when we had Milo Yiannopoulos come to campus, I was in the minority of the group that I was talking with. I was talking with some of the upper administration, and I said, you know, I really think because it was a group of students who asked him to come, I think we need to allow him to come. But that doesn't mean that we have to give him an audience, and we don't have to give him what he's looking for, which is attention. If we have a huge protest and there's violence, his name gets all over the news, and that's what he wants. He is seeking attention. And so we helped some students who wanted to do something organize a counter event the same night somewhere else. And some of our alums, once they heard that this was happening, actually they reserved tickets and then didn't go. So half the tickets were not used, which I thought was fabulous. My favorite picture from the entire night was that they had barriers set up in case there were protesters. And so they had a picture of the barriers and no one was there. And I thought it was beautiful.
We're talking with Professor Jenny Lamb from the Communication Department here at the University of Delaware on Campus Voices this morning. And I think Sam and Allie are going to ask you some questions about some other things that have happened at UD.
Just this month, there was an anti-Semitic poster found, I think, at Kirkbride. And the way that our university kind of handled it, there were two kind of opinions about it. I know Sam and I didn't even know about the event until it was in the review, opinion about how the university handled it. So what is Delaware's role in that? What was the thought process of how they handled it? How did people react to that? That kind of thing.
So I wasn't privy to the thought process because I didn't know about it either until the review article came out. But my guess is that they wanted to contain it as much as possible. They were probably trying to address the group that they thought would be most affected by this, which was anti-Semitic. So I think they sent it out to Hillel. I think it was not a great choice in the sense that it would have been a good opportunity to have more discussions, particularly since this sort of thing is happening across the country. The Southern Poverty Law Center has actually started tracking these incidents of posting flyers around the country, and there's been a lot of them this fall. And so I think it was a mistake not to take the opportunity to have that broader discussion on campus and just assume that the Hillel people were the only folks who would care.
What are these alt-right, white nationalists, whatever you want to call them, what do you think they want to accomplish by putting up flyers and posters on college campuses?
I think that they feel that college students are at a very formative time in their lives, and that if they can reach some college-age, well-educated students, that it will bolster their credibility as a movement. They're trying very hard to not be the dudes in white sheets anymore. They're trying to be very careful about what language they use to make their perspectives much more palatable. And so I think that they really feel that they have some possibility of attracting, I think, particularly male college students to their movement.
With the white nationalist speaker in Florida, again, to bring that up, I remember reading somewhere that one of the real reasons why he went was because college kids are so malleable at this stage in their life. And I think that's even scarier if you essentially want to take advantage of college students who don't have their own ideas really formed yet and just kind of impose.
Well, pharmaceutical companies come to campus to recruit students. Why can't white nationalists?
Yeah.
I didn't mean to put a paw on the conversation there,
no,
but that gets to the heart of free speech.
Yeah, it does.
Because faculty like Jenny and I think that one of the reasons you guys are here is to get a job. They come here to recruit. Why can't the alt-right?
I guess that just goes back to at the beginning when you were saying, what is hate speech to people? Like that, Sam and I, is the definition. But what you're saying, Richard, it depends on who you are.
I do think that the purpose of a pharmaceutical company recruiting to come get you to have a job is a little different than the white nationalists recruiting you to come be racist. So I do think there's some difference there. And I think that universities across the country have rules about what kinds of posters get put up and the approval process that they have to go through. And so I think that most places can legitimately take those down without sort of breaking the content neutral regulation that they've set forth.
So what do you think is the best way for the university to kind of start these dialogues between faculty, students, just world, like on campus?
I think that we need to have ongoing programming about these things. And we've actually tried the last 2.5, 3 years. I've actually been working with the Vice Provost for Diversity to do programming to bring speakers to campus or to show mini movies and have discussions about the tension between hate speech and free speech. The Vice Provost for Diversity and I are working together to try to put together a symposium for spring of 2019. That will actually bring some of the top names in terms of scholars and lawyers and journalists and also activists to come to campus to speak to this issue and to try to come up with some sort of best practices about how we can deal with these sorts of things.
Do you think university students, I don't want to say care, but do you think most of them care? I mean, we're at a 20,000 person school. Like, I'm sure not everybody's really thinking about this kind of stuff. It's not really affecting them. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So I think that's part of what happens is that when Milo Yiannopoulos comes to visit, then more people care. And so while you need to have the ongoing discussion, just so it sort of becomes part of the air you breathe, I think that it's also important that the university react when specific incidents happen, because those specific incidents make it more salient for people. That's part of why I think that that flyer that got posted, they sort of missed an opportunity to have another, like, very pointed discussion that could be made more salient by the fact that this happened on our campus.
So we've been talking about how an institution should react, but on social media, it's kind of one-on-one or sometimes one versus all, it feels. What would the best way for people to handle hate speech on there when they're facing anonymous people just coming at everybody?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. I do think there's a role for the medium to do something. So Facebook and Twitter and such, they do have a role in helping to police that. But there's also individual people have been taking some responsibility for reporting things. I think there has to be that kind of structure in place as well. So that, because again, it's not going to catch everything. You can use words and that are, you know, sort of not inherently hateful to mean something very hateful. And so I think it's important to have sort of human eyes on it as well. The other thing that some people have done, which I find really interesting, is there are groups of people who actually look for things that have been very blatantly racist online, and they track down the person who said them or wrote them. And they expose them to either their family or their friends or their boss. And they hope that public pressure from the people around that person will sort of limit that to some degree. I have mixed feelings about that. I think in some sense it's a good idea. But contacting somebody's employer seems to me like, if that person's already having some anger issues, which I think is usually at the root of hate, that getting them fired from their job isn't going to really improve their perspective on the world. There was an example of a woman who'd gotten these horrible, like, rape threats and that sort of thing, who actually tracked down the boys who'd sent these to her and then tracked down their moms and showed their moms what their sons had said. And that I thought was awesome because, you know how moms are. I think it's different in the case, like in Charlottesville, there were people beating up other people and there were very clear pictures about who the people were. And so people were sharing those pictures and sometimes even identifying who the perpetrators were and sharing that with the police. But I think that's a very different thing than actually going after the person yourself.
Yeah, going to his friends and relations and employer. Yeah.
I remember when the Pulse nightclub shooting happened and the Westboro Baptist Church was down there to protest. You guys familiar with the Westboro Baptist Church?
Yes.
So
they're aren't they the ones who say they don't deserve a Christian burial because...
Yes, exactly.
Because they're gay.
So what people did, because they had they got a permit, and so they had the right to be there to protest. So a community theater group down there got together and made these costumes, and they stood on ladders with these angel costumes. And when the loved ones were going by in the funeral procession, they stood up and they blocked the signs so that the loved ones didn't have to see that hatred. And so I think there's some very creative ways to respond. There was a group in Florida also that when Richard Spencer came, there was a brewery there that said, "We'll give you a free draft of beer for every 2 tickets you bring in for Richard Spencer." Again, another sort of way to respond that's not violent, but it's creative and it, you know, makes the point.
That often happens where you get a free speech dispute turns to violence because, again, people aren't there to listen to each other. They're there to shout down the other side.
Right.
One of the things that strikes me is, you remember that back in 2015, we had the decoration of the tree that was mistaken for a noose, and all of a sudden, oh my God, you know, the campus erupts. But I thought Acting President Nancy Target did a pretty good job of handling that. What really concerned me about that was, what is the climate like at the University of Delaware that someone could draw that conclusion that that's a noose in the tree?
I think, again, that it was a very contextual thing, because I don't remember who the speaker was, but there was a very controversial speaker that the night before somebody saw that. I want to say she was here about gun rights, or it was something traditionally associated with conservative perspectives. And Black Lives Matter had protested outside of Memorial Hall. I think she was in Memorial Hall. It ended up being sort of the inside of a lantern that was left there. When somebody walked by the next day, it was right near where the Black Lives Matter folks had been protesting. And so I think in some ways it was a contextual thing. But it also, I mean, I think you can't escape that it did say something about the fact that someone thought that was plausible. What was concerning about that, too, was that the Black Lives Matter folks, some still don't feel like they don't accept the official explanation that that was a lantern thing. They actually believe that the police were lying about that. That misconception about what it was still resonates today. And so I think we have a lot of work to do on this campus to make folks feel more comfortable. I don't know if you guys saw, but there was a video out a couple weeks ago where it was a group of Bikers for Trump or something like that, that were protesting, or not protesting, but had a rally in D.C. on the green. And there were some Black Lives Matter protesters who came. And the guy who was the head of the Bikers for Trump said, "You know what? I'm going to have you come up here for 2 minutes and say what you want to say." And he did. And first of all, the guy from Black Lives Matter could not have been expecting to give a speech that day. And he did such a good job at addressing it to that audience. It was really cool to see what happened afterwards, because, you know, initially there's this the confrontation that you'd expect. But afterwards, there were some head biker dude came up and wanted to have his daughter take a picture with the guy from Black Lives Matter who talked. And, you know, they talked about, like, "So I don't agree with what you're saying, but I feel like something's wrong, and I have the right to say that I feel like something's wrong. That's what freedom of expression is." And people were very supportive of that kind of thing. If people can remember each other's humanity, that is where change can be made. Because when you stop seeing the person as a stereotype and you start seeing them as another human being, then it becomes very difficult to say the things that you are saying about them if it's very negative.
Wow, this has just been amazing. Jenny Lamb from the University of Delaware Department of Communication, thank you for coming down to Campus Voices and joining Sam, Allie, and me.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.